It was so powerful, such a huge sound, that I blocked it. It scared me to death. I blocked it, and I cannot bring it back up to consciousness.
Howard Lutnick, CEO, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower. The loudest sound I'd ever heard.
Gregory Fried. I can't even give you an analogy.
Bill Spade. Like 6 or 8 subway cars pulling into the station at the same time with their brakes.
Detective Steven Stefanakos. Like 1,000 freight trains crashed.
Kenneth Escoffery, firefighter, ladder 20, FDNY. Like an incoming missile.
James Dobson, paramedic. Like an avalanche.
Gulmar Parga. Like a giant chandelier, all the glass breaking.
Like 30,000 jets taking off.
Like a machine gun.
Joe Massian, technology consultant, Port Authority, North Tower, 70th floor. A pop and then a sift, like taking a bag of sugar and pouring it into a container.
Al Kim. I told everyone, incoming, run.
Constance Labetti. We really thought that the end of the world was upon us.
The collapse of the South Tower instantly trapped guests, staff, and rescuers inside the Marriott Hotel, located between the Twin Towers, as wreckage pounded the roof.
Frank Rosano. I was standing there watching the TV. I said to myself, Jesus Christ, if I leave this building today without my stuff, they're never going to let me back in this building tonight. I started packing all my documents and getting everything ready to go, thinking, I wonder if I can get a bellman to come up and help me take all of this stuff down. At that point, the building shook, as if you were in an earthquake. I looked out the window and what had been a bright, sunny day suddenly turned pitch black. It was as if a curtain of concrete and steel had come falling down, like the curtain at a play. I could literally see it coming down past the window, almost in slow motion, turning everything pitch black.
Jeff Johnson. The entire building started to shudder. It was lights out. I fell down.
Frank Rosano. It was as if the building was being hit by artillery fire. You could feel the building breaking up around you.
Jeff Johnson. We immediately called for the other members of our crew. It's a military thing. We called Pat. Yeah. John. Yeah. Lou. It's Jeff. We had us four, and then we called Ruben. And we didn't get an answer. We kept screaming, Ruben! Ruben!
Frank Rosano. I yelled out into what was left of the hallway. Is anybody there? I hear a voice that said, come this way. The room was located almost right next to the fire staircase. Right at the base of the door jamb, in some rubble, was a New York City fireman. I learned later that his name was Jeff Johnson. They said, are you okay? He said to me, are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm fine. How are you? Is there anything I can do to help you? He said, no, I'm fine. I want you to go down the fire stairs.
Jeff Johnson. Immediately in front of us was a complete wall of debris.
Frank Rosano. When I got to the 4th floor landing and began to walk down the stairs to where the 3rd floor landing would be, it was blocked with rubble. I began trying to move rubble away and create an opening. I got enough rubble out of the way that I could squeeze through. On the 3rd floor landing were 3 men and the banquet manager of the hotel.
Jeff Johnson. We gave immediate maydays on the radio that as a unit we were missing a member. Nobody was answering us. We did hear somebody calling out on the radio a mayday. He was a fireman and he didn't know where he was. I'm trapped, but I don't know where I am. That's the most heart-wrenching and worst-case scenario.
Frank Rosano. Within a few minutes, Jeff Johnson came down. He was with another fireman now that he had met coming down the stairs. Jeff looked around. An I-beam was leaning up against the landing on the 3rd floor and was wedged on a ledge on the 2nd floor. Jeff climbed down the I-beam, walked along the ledge, came back, and yelled up to us. Each of you are going to have to climb down the I-beam and walk along the ledge and go back into the building. We have got to find a way out. I also recall him saying, look, nobody's coming. Nobody is coming for us. Any of the firemen or rescue people who are tasked at getting people out of the building, they are dead. If they were in the street, they are dead. If they were in the buildings, they are dead. Nobody is coming to get us. We have to get out on our own.
The unprecedented collapse, the first time a high-rise building had ever fallen, was witnessed by millions around the world on television and in person across the New York region, including by those who had already evacuated from the World Trade Center and Lower Manhattan.
Beverly Eckert. I suddenly heard this loud explosion through the phone. It reverberated for several seconds. We held our breath. I know we both realized what was about to happen. Then I heard a sharp crack, followed by the sound of an avalanche. I heard Sean gasp once as the floor fell out from underneath him. I called his name into the phone over and over. Kathy Pavlik. I ran into a woman on the street who I knew from my office, Denise. We started up the ramp to go to the Brooklyn Bridge, but then I saw all these fighter planes. I didn't know if they were ours or not. I said to Denise, we can't go on a bridge. We can't go on a landmark. I really thought that the planes belonged to somebody other than us. We turned around to get off the bridge. We heard a noise. We looked up. And we saw Tower 2 collapse.
Robert Small, office manager, Morgan Stanley, South Tower, 72nd floor, now on the Brooklyn Bridge. It looked like a 4th of July sparkler. It swayed to one side and fell within itself, then it was gone. You can see the glitter from the metal and the glass as this big gray cloud formed.
Michael McAvoy? In seconds, it was gone. People screamed again. I looked at my coworker Brian and said, holy shit, 20,000 people just died.
Monica O'Leary, former employee, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower. I remember standing there with my neighbor John saying, where the hell did that go? Where the hell did that go? Where did the building go? Where'd they go?
Judith Wine. My heart dropped. I thought of everybody who was still up there. It was their end.
Melinda Murphy. When the building fell, it became a personal story for me because my husband worked a couple of blocks away. It became, oh my God, my husband may not be alive. On camera, I was fine. As soon as they told me I was clear, I was a mess.
Peter Jennings. We went into silent mode. It was not necessary for us to add our own anxiety or shock. It was all evident for everybody. Throughout my entire career, I have always been conscious that there are times when some people on television talk too much. Silence, or natural sound on occasion, is infinitely more powerful and relevant.
Aaron Brown, anchor, CNN. The hardest words I've ever spoken on TV in 25 years were these. The United States is under attack. It took me too long, perhaps a half hour too long, to utter those words. They were there, I assure you. I knew what it was.
Kathy Pavlik. We stood there for a minute, and then the clouds started to come after us. For the first time that day, I really thought we were going to die.
Richard Grasso, Chairman and CEO, New York Stock Exchange. When the South Tower was coming down, my head of security came racing across the floor. He was uncharacteristically shaken. He said, we're learning the city's gone code black, which means the mayor's dead, the police commissioner's dead, and the fire commissioner's dead. At that point, I turned to my colleague and said, ring the bell. We're closed.
This is not my day. I'm not dying here. Inside the cloud. The South Tower collapsed at an estimated speed of nearly 124 miles an hour, and later estimates held that the winds generated from the collapse of the World Trade Center peaked as high as 70 miles per hour, driving the accompanying cloud of debris scores of blocks away as the hurricane force wind spread devastation throughout Lower Manhattan.
Rudy Giuliani. I heard someone yell, "The tower is coming down." I heard a big noise, saw the desk shaking. My first impression of "the tower is coming down" was that the radio tower on the top of the building had come down. I certainly didn't have the impression that the whole building had come down.
Rosmaris Fernandez. I could not believe that the World Trade Center was coming down. I stared at the buildings coming down in amazement until I came to my senses and realized it was time to run.
Ada Dolch. That was the moment when I said, "Okay, this is the end." I saw this tsunami wave of dust and debris coming in our direction. It was coming fast. It felt like pins and needles on your back. It was beyond frightening.
Heather Ordover. I remember seeing the solid as a wall smoke coming down Trinity Place right at Battery Park.
Jean Potter. I remember thinking, maybe I am going to die. Maybe it is my time. How do I outrun this? I was in such a state of shock. A police officer took me by the hand and dragged me into a subway station, the Day Street subway station, and we kept going deeper and deeper.
Dan Potter. There was a blue tarp out in front of the firehouse. I guess they were going to use it for triage. There was a Chinese man on it, and he had a broken leg. When the tower started coming down, I grabbed him as best I could and started pulling him back.
Detective David Brink. We went under one of the overhangs by Building 6. It was like when you were doing one of those school drills back in the day with the nuclear threats from Russia. They would tell you to duck and cover and go under your school desk. The only thing we really had to duck and cover under was these overhangs.
Howard Lutnick, CEO, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower. I looked over my shoulder, and there was this big, giant, black tornado of smoke chasing me. I dove under a car, and the black smoke went foosh.
Jan Kahn, New York Metropolitan Transportation Council, North Tower. A hurricane-type wind blew us to the floor.
Lieutenant Joseph Torillo, as I was running, that air caught the back of my helmet, and I saw my helmet fly away. My helmet was flying faster and higher, and I could see it as I was running. It was like the Wizard of Oz. At that point, as the building came down lower and lower, the air pressure was so strong, they estimate almost like a tornado force. The air pressure lifted me off of my feet, and I was flying through the air.
Tracy Donahue, transit officer, NYPD. It hit so hard, I went flying. I don't know how far I went. I went flying. I could feel myself in the air. I landed on my knees and on my hand. It was dark. It was so black in there. You couldn't see anything, and I couldn't breathe. I was choking.
Ian Oldiger, staff, Ellis Island. The smoke came right up the street like fingers. It was really gray and dirty. We couldn't see the towers, so we didn't know what had fallen.
Linda Crooner. There was this gigantic cannonball of dust approaching me along these streets. I started running because I wanted to avoid this gargantuan ball of debris approaching me, a little bit like the Indiana Jones cannonball.
Joe Massian. My fear was that the buildings would begin to domino and I'd get caught between the two dominoes. I believe my picture was taken right when I passed the church. You can see the tree line in the photo.
Gregory Fried. Your brain couldn't adjust to the concept of the World Trade Center coming down on you.
Ian Oldiger. We started running south. We ran right up to the water. There's a guardrail there, big iron handrail. A lot of people ran up with us. There were a couple of hundred people right on this handrail. You're looking in and you're looking down, and it's Hudson smoke. Hudson smoke. A lot of people looked down really temptingly at that water.
James Filomeno, firefighter, Marine 1, FDNY. We were docked near the pier. I was watching people running toward us like a herd of cattle. I watched debris coming down on them. People were jumping headfirst onto the deck and screaming. People were trying to hand me their kids. Take my baby. I don't want to stay here. Take the baby. People fell in the water. It was horrible.
James Cowan, Harbor Unit, NYPD. We were yelling for people in the water to answer us. There were dozens of people in the water.
Vanessa Lawrence. I only just got out of the building when it was coming down. I started running across the road to the subway and the big blast came up. As soon as I put my foot down on the sidewalk, the building was down and I couldn't see anything.
Chief Joseph Pfeiffer. I heard all the crashing and the steel and then the street went totally black. As a firefighter, you expect blackness inside a burning building. Outside in broad daylight, you don't.
Bruno Dellinger. In about 5 seconds, darkness fell upon us with an unbelievable violence. Even more striking, there was no more sound. Sound didn't carry anymore because the air was so thick.
Melinda Murphy, traffic reporter, WPIX-TV, airborne over New York Harbor. This incredible dust cloud came up, and it looked like all of Lower Manhattan was gone.
Dan Potter. Then it started. The rain of the debris. Everything hitting around you. I dove to the floor, covered myself up. I figured, this is it. The force buckled the metal doors of the firehouse. They blew out every window. The ambulance that was up in the front there was crushed.
Dr. Charles Hirsch. The pummeling by debris seemed to go on forever. It was probably a minute or so.
Edward Aswad, Jr., officer, NYPD. I could feel stuff going up my legs, the soot and the debris.
Lieutenant Joseph Torillo. I got hit over the head with a piece of steel, and my whole head was split open. Huge chunks of concrete were hitting my body. Every time another chunk hit me, I could hear my bones snapping.
William Jimeno. I felt a lot of pain. I grabbed my helmet and I grabbed for my radio, which was on my left lapel, and I was yelling, 813, which is Port Authority police code for officer down. 813, 813, officers down, 813. Jimeno, we're down. Our team is down. We were getting pummeled with debris. I was trying to fight for my life. At one point, something hit my left hand, my radio went flying. A big piece of concrete must have hit my helmet. It came flying off, ripped the chin strap right off, and I covered my head. As fast as this was happening, it ended.
Sergeant John McLaughlin, PAPD. I thought I had died. I lost all sense. I had no sight. I had no smell. I had no hearing. Everything was just silent.
Al Kim. I was burning. I remember being really hot, like head to toe, like, this is bad, really bad, like hotter than a sauna or steam room. My shirt was gone. It was all ripped and burned. I lost all my nostril hair. I lost a part of my eyebrows and all my eyelashes were gone too.
Elia Zedania. I tripped over something and I ended up on top of somebody, a police officer. He was screaming, my eyes are burning, and at the same time telling me, don't worry, everything is going to be fine. I think that is the mind of somebody who is trained like this. He was screaming. I'm talking about screaming. And at the same time saying, well, don't worry, everything is going to be fine. We are getting out of here.
Captain Sean Crowley. I've never heard screaming like I did on that day. It was all men. It was unbelievable screaming. I'm thinking about how I'm probably going to die and about my kids.
Tracy Donahue. People were screaming. I was screaming. Shut up, shut up, shut up. Everyone calmed down. I was like, I'm a police officer. We're gonna get out of here. I don't know how far my voice can carry in there, and I didn't know if we were really encapsulated in cement and would never get out.
Vanessa Lawrence. I remember at one point feeling amazingly calm. It always feels strange to say this, but I thought I couldn't breathe anymore, and I actually got really, really calm and went, okay, it's fine. I can't breathe anymore, and this is okay. Then I got this feeling in my stomach that went, no, you can do it. You can do it. Do it. I got this boost again, and it was, okay, I can fight this. I can. That was one of the strangest feelings of them all, that calmness of going, I give up, but then that pound in my stomach. I also then felt this arm beside me and this voice. I clung hold of it, and this voice says, we've got to wait till it settles. I remember turning and looking, and he'd got his coat and put it over us both, and then I saw his badge, and it was a fireman. I remember grabbing tight hold of him. The power of it, having somebody there beside me, helped me.
Tracy Donahue. In the academy, they said, if you think you're gonna die, you're gonna die. So I'm not gonna die here. This is not my day. I'm not dying here.
Lieutenant Joseph Tarillo. I was buried under the South Tower. I can't breathe. I'm suffocating. It's darker than midnight. I could see nothing. Detective Sergeant Joe Blozes. After the building collapsed, there was a calmness that I'll never forget. When the dust cloud came, you heard nothing, and you saw nothing.
Monsignor John Delendick, Chaplain, FDNY. People I was standing with were all of a sudden dead. I looked one way, and they went another way, and didn't make it out.
Tracy Donahue. I was thinking of my family, and I was thinking of my annoying little puppy I had at home that was driving my mother crazy, and I was like, she's gonna kill me being stuck with this dog.
Elia Zedeno. I was trying to breathe, and I was trying to spit out what I had in my mouth, but I couldn't, so I had to dig my hand in. I dug my hand into my mouth and pulled out a lot of stuff. I was going to be able to breathe, but the moment that I pulled the stuff out, more stuff came in.
Captain Sean Crowley, picture taking a handful of flour and sticking it up your nose and in your mouth. That's what breathing was like.
Elia Zedeno, there were these desperate moments I couldn't breathe. I kept digging and digging and digging and digging until the dirt started to settle a little bit and I was able to get that first breath. Heather Ordover. I crouched next to a man with a green-striped Oxford cloth shirt. I helped him cut it with my Swiss Army knife scissors so he could put a piece over his nose and mouth. We shared water.
Ada Dolch. Everyone kept saying you had to put water on tissues or on a piece of cloth, wash your face, or put something over your mouth so you don't breathe in that smoke.
Heather Ordover. I caught up to a police officer. Do you know where we're going? He said, no, Staten Island Ferry. Have you been trained for this kind of thing? Half laugh. Sort of.
Ada Dolch. I felt like I was choking. I got up and I could take tiny little bits of swallow. I couldn't do a deep swallow because it hurt. A man said, you have to take water and spit. I didn't have water, but I remember saying to him, I'm the principal. I don't spit. You teach the kids that's not what you do. He said, you need to take water and you need to gargle. He was standing by an old antique water fountain in the park. I took water. I spit. I cleaned my throat. I spit.
Rosmaris Fernandez. The air cleared out a little. I found a couple of my friends and I felt less worried. I knew that I was not alone anymore. A teacher from the nearby High School of Economics and Finance asked every student to follow him to the Brooklyn Bridge, and so we did. I then lost him and kept on walking north on the FDR Drive.
William Jimeno. There was a lot of dust. I looked up, and about 30 feet above me, I could see light coming in. Apparently, there was a hole there. I started feeling a lot of pain on my left side. I could see a big, thick wall of concrete on me. I was trying to get my bearings, but I couldn't really see. That's when I heard Sergeant McLaughlin say, sound off, where is everybody, sound off. Dominic Pizzullo was buried to my left in a push-up position. Dominic said, Pizzullo. I said, Jimeno. That's all we heard. For the next 2 minutes, I would yell, Chris, for Christopher Amoroso. And A-Rod, which was Antonio Rodriguez's nickname. A-Rod, Chris, A-Rod, Chris. That's when Dominic said, Willie, they're in a better place.
Sir, authority to engage? Inside the PIOC. Underneath the north lawn of the White House, the vice president and assembled aides attempted to comprehend the crisis from inside the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, aka the White House bunker, and tried to figure out how many more hijacked planes were in the air. They knew of at least one, United Flight 93.
Mary Matlin, we saw on TV the building collapse.
Commander Anthony Barnes, Deputy Director, Presidential Contingency Programs, White House. There was a deafening silence and a lot of gasping and oh my God and that kind of thing.
Mary Matlin, disbelief.
Commander Anthony Barnes, there were four or five very large 55-inch television screens in the PIOC. We would put the different news stations, ABC, CBS, Fox, NBC, on those monitors. I remember Cheney being as flabbergasted as the rest of us were, sitting there watching on these monitors. Back in those days, a 55-inch TV monitor was a really big TV. It was almost bigger than life as the towers collapsed.
Dick Cheney, Vice President. In the years since, I've heard speculation that I'm a different man after 9/11. I wouldn't say that. But I'll freely admit that watching a coordinated, devastating attack on our country from an underground bunker at the White House can affect how you view your responsibilities.
Mary Matlin, we had to go right back to work.
Richard Clark, Counterterrorism Advisor, White House. Many of us thought that we might not leave the White House alive.
Matthew Waxman. One of the things we were all very conscious of down in the PIOC was that the White House Situation Room was staffed with our close colleagues and friends who were staying in those spots despite a clear danger. The Situation Room, which is only half a floor below ground, was abuzz with activity. Some of the colleagues who continued to work in it were people who wouldn't normally be posted there, but they felt the responsibility to stay there to help manage the crisis. Especially early in the day, there was a palpable sense that close friends and colleagues might be in some significant danger.
Ian Reifield, Special Agent, U.S. Secret Service. There was a sense of frustration, too, because we were sitting there. Everybody wanted to fight back. We're trained to go to the problem, and we were sitting there. There was a lot of tension in that regard. You wanted to do something to protect the complex and the office of the president even better than we were. But we were doing the best we could with what we had.
Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor, White House. Norm Mineta, the Transportation Secretary, was tracking tail numbers of the aircraft on a yellow pad. He was calling out what happened to 671, what happened to 123. He was trying to make sense of what was going on.
Nick Calio, Director of Legislative Affairs, White House. Norm Mineta was sitting in front of these TV screens that had all these planes on them. It was pretty remarkable when you saw the number of planes in the air.
Condoleezza Rice. My first thought was, get a message out to the world that the United States of America has not been decapitated. These pictures must have been terrifying. It must have seemed like the United States of America was coming apart. My test was to keep my head about me and to make certain that people around the world didn't panic.
Nick Calio. The activity was so high and things were happening so quickly, at least for me, there wasn't any time to be afraid.
Matthew Waxman. There was this stark contrast between the chaotic information bombardment about what was happening around Washington, around the country, some of it accurate, some of it inaccurate, and the calm and careful deliberation of a lot of the senior decision makers.
Nick Calio. The vivid memory I have was we were in this cocoon, receiving and sending all this information, at the same time not knowing where our families were. It was probably mid-afternoon before we were able to try and contact our families. That was worrisome. I didn't know where my kids were. There was an overriding uncertainty about what was going on, what would actually happen, and what would have to follow. Colonel Bob Marr, we're in foreign territory. We are used to protecting the shores way out overseas. Our processes and procedures weren't designed for this.
Major General Larry Arnold, we can't see the aircraft. We don't know where it is because we don't have any radars pointing into the U.S. Anything in the United States was considered friendly by definition.
Lieutenant Heather Lucky Penny, F-16 pilot, D.C. Air National Guard. Our chain of command didn't go up to NORAD, didn't go up through the 1st Air Force, which oversaw operations in the United States. They had no method to be able to reach down or even be able to know that the D.C. National Guard was there and available. There were no rules of engagement. I hadn't even thought about what that kind of mission might be like on American soil.
Commander Anthony Barnes. I was running liaison between the ops guys who had Pentagon officials on the phone and the conference room where the principals were. The Pentagon thought there was another hijacked airplane, and they were asking for permission to shoot down an unidentified hijacked commercial aircraft. I asked the vice president that question, and he answered it in the affirmative. I asked again to be sure. Sir, I am confirming that you have given permission. For me, being a military member and an aviator, understanding the absolute depth of what that question was and what that answer was, I wanted to make sure that there was no mistake whatsoever about what was being asked. Without hesitation, in the affirmative, he said any confirmed hijacked airplane may be engaged and shot down.
Colonel Matthew Klimo, no one had ever contemplated the need to shoot down a civilian airliner.
Major General Larry Arnold, I told Rick Findlay in Colorado Springs at NORAD's headquarters, Rick, we have to have permission. We may have to shoot down this aircraft that is coming toward Washington, D.C. We need presidential authority.
Major Dan Raisin Kane, F-16 pilot, D.C. Air National Guard. I handed our wing commander the phone to talk to the high levels of government to get the rules of engagement.
Dick Cheney, it had to be done. Once the plane became hijacked, even if it had a load of passengers on board who obviously weren't part of any hijacking attempt. Having seen what had happened in New York and the Pentagon, you really didn't have any choice. It wasn't a close call.
Matthew Waxman. That really grabs you by the collar when you hear the vice president giving the order to shoot down an unidentified aircraft flying toward the national capital. That stands out as one of the most frightening moments of the day, partly because it highlighted the sense of continuing danger. There was also the realization of the enormous dilemmas that faced decision makers at that moment with very little time and imperfect information.
Commander Anthony Barnes, I knew, without a doubt in my mind, that that was a historical precedent, that never before had we given permission to shoot down a commercial airliner. I got back on the phone. It was a general of some sort in the Pentagon. And on that secure line I was talking on made sure that he understood that I had posed the question to the national authority, and the answer was in the affirmative. We made sure that we did not stutter or stumble because the emotion at that point was very, very high. Fortunately, we didn't have to use that authority.
Josh Bolton, Deputy Chief of Staff, White House. Vice President Cheney was very steady, very calm. He clearly had been through crises before and did not appear to be in shock like many of us.
Commander Anthony Barnes. The president was safer aboard Air Force One than trying to come home, and Mr. Cheney, without question, he was in charge. He was in charge of the space, and we would bring him information.
Dick Cheney, as bad as the events of 9/11 were, some of us had practiced exercises for far more dangerous and difficult circumstances. An all-out Soviet nuclear attack on the United States. That helped. That training kicked in that morning.
Eric Edelman, Principal Deputy Assistant to the Vice President for National Security Affairs, White House. He was a calming influence on people because you'd sort of be embarrassed to, in front of him, betray any sense of, oh my God.
Condoleezza Rice. There were times that day that it felt like an out-of-body experience. But you keep functioning, even though you don't really believe it's happening.
We're in a little trouble here. The military responds. With the order from Vice President Cheney, the military scrambled to find planes it could bring into the fight, even if that meant launching them unarmed, launching them on a kamikaze mission to crash their own fighters into hijacked airliners. It was an unbelievable and unprecedented mission, the weight of which was not lost on the pilots gathered to take it on. What was not yet widely known was that the United 93 passengers were planning, at the same time, to take the plane over it themselves.
Colonel Matthew Klimo, it was a very painful discussion for all of us. We didn't want the burden of shooting down the airliner to be on the shoulders of a single fighter pilot. But we also didn't want to have that pilot go all the way up the chain of command to get permission to shoot. It was decided the pilot should do their best to try to wave the airplane off, and if it's clear the airplane is headed into a heavily populated area, the authority to shoot can be given to a regional commander.
Lieutenant Heather Luckypenny. This sounds counterintuitive, but when the magnitude of the situation hit me, I really lost all emotion. I was really much more focused on what are the things I need to do to enable us to protect our capital? What are the things I need to do to facilitate us getting airborne?
Brigadier General David Worley, Commander, D.C. Air National Guard. My translation of the rules to SAS, Lieutenant Colonel Mark Sasseville, F-16 pilot, was, "You have weapons-free flight lead control," I said. "Do you understand what I'm asking you to do?" They both, Sasseville and Lieutenant Heather Luckypenny, said yes. I told them to be careful.
Lieutenant Colonel Mark Sasseville, F-16 pilot, U.S. Air Force. As we're going out to the jets, Lucky and I had a quick conversation about what it is that we were going to do and how we were basically going to do the unthinkable if we had to.
Lieutenant Heather Luckypenny, we would be ramming the aircraft. We didn't have weapons on board to shoot the airplane down. Both Sass and I had 105 bullets lead-nosed. As we were putting on our flight gear in the life support shop, Sass looked at me and said, "I'll ram the cockpit." I made the decision I would take the tail off the aircraft.
Lieutenant Colonel Mark Sasseville, we didn't have a whole lot of options.
Lieutenant Heather Luckypenny, I had never been trained to scramble the aircraft. It would typically take about 20 minutes to start the jets, get the avionics systems going, go through all the pre-flight checks to make sure the systems were operating properly, program the computers in the aircraft. That's not even including the time to look at the forms, do the walk around of the airplane and whatnot. We usually planned about half an hour to 40 minutes from the time you walked out the door to the time that you actually took off.
George Degnan, Vice Commander, 113th Wing, Andrews Air Force Base, Prince George's County, Maryland. We did everything humanly possible to get the aircraft in the air.
Lieutenant Heather Luckypenny, I just got my radios up and I was yelling at my crew chief, "Pull the chocks!" He pulled the chocks and I pushed my throttle. The crew chief was still running under the tail so that my gear would come up. There are safety pins that are all in the airplane, and so they were pulling all those safety pins as I was taxiing to go do an immediate takeoff. I didn't even have an inertia navigation unit. I didn't have any of that set up. It was lucky it was a clear blue day because we didn't have all the avionics. They were not yet awake when we took off.
Lieutenant Colonel Mark Sasseville, I was thinking, wow, we're in a little trouble here.
Lieutenant Heather Luckypenny, Sass and I fully expected to intercept Flight 93 and take it down.
Lieutenant Colonel Mark Sasseville, I was going into this moral or ethical justification of the needs of the many versus the needs of the few.
Lieutenant Heather Luckypenny, I genuinely believed that it was going to be the last time I took off. If we did it right, this would be it.
Major General Larry Arnold. Bob Marr quotes me as saying that I told him that we would take lives in the air to save lives on the ground.
Lieutenant Heather Luckypenny, seeing the Pentagon was surreal. It was totally surreal to see this billowing black smoke. We didn't get high. We were at about 3,000 feet. We never got above 3,000 feet, at least on that first sweep out.
Lieutenant Colonel Mark Sassoville. There was all this smoke in my cockpit. It made me nauseous, to be honest with you, not from an, this stinks. It was more from an, oh my God, we've been hit on our own soil, and we've been hit big. I couldn't believe they had gotten through and they managed to pull off this attack.
Lieutenant Heather Lucky Penny. The real heroes are the passengers on Flight 93 who were willing to sacrifice themselves.
Lieutenant Colonel Mark Sassoville. They made the decision we didn't have to make.
Lieutenant Heather Lucky Penny. I don't remember how many miles we got away from D.C., but we flew quite a bit down the Potomac. We said we need to go back over and fly over D.C. because we've clearly sanitized the area. When we returned to D.C., that was when things began to settle down.
Let's get them. The fourth crash. A few minutes before 10 a.m., United Flight 93 passenger Edward Felt, a 41-year-old married father of two who was traveling as part of his job as a computer engineer for BEA Systems, called 911 from the plane and reached emergency dispatcher John Shaw in Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania. It was the first tip to Pennsylvania authorities that there was trouble in the skies overhead. Felt explained to the confused dispatcher that he was on board a 757 flying from Newark to San Francisco and that there was a hijacking in progress. They were somewhere over southeastern Pennsylvania. Shaw immediately turned to his colleagues and shouted for someone to get the FAA and the airport on the line. He said, "There's a plane going down."
Alice Ann Hoagland. The uniqueness of Flight 93 is that it was in the air longer than the other flights. People on board were able to find out about the fate of the other three flights and mount an effort to thwart the hijackers, even if they weren't able to save their own lives.
Dina Burnett, wife of United Flight 93 passenger Tom Burnett. It was silent, and I could feel my heart racing. Tom said, "We're waiting until we're over a rural area. We're going to take back the airplane." I became very frightened, and I begged, "No, no, Tom, just sit down, be still, be quiet, and don't draw attention to yourself." He said, "No, Dina, if they're going to crash this plane, we're going to have to do something." I asked, "What about the authorities?" He said, "We can't wait for authorities. I don't know what they can do anyway. It's up to us." He said, "I think we can do it." Neither of us said anything for a few seconds. Then I said, "What do you want me to do? What can I do?" "Pray, Dina. Just pray." "I am praying. I love you." Tom said, "Don't worry. We're going to do something." Then he hung up. He never called back.
Lisa Jefferson. As that plane took a dive, I could hear the commotion in the background. I heard the flight attendants screaming, people hollering out, "Oh my God, Jesus, help us." Todd Beamer asked me if he didn't make it, would I please call his wife? I told him I would, but I asked him if he would like me to connect him to her right then. He said no, he didn't want to upset her. She was expecting their third child in January, and he knew she was home alone. He gave me his home phone number.
Lisbeth Glick. Jeremy said there were three other guys as big as him, and they were going to jump on the hijacker with the bomb and try to take back the plane. He asked if I thought that was a good idea. We debated a little bit. He said that they were going to take a vote and asked what did I think he should do. I said, "You need to do it." He's a very strong man and large, 6 feet, 220. He was a national judo champion, so he was really well equipped with self-defense. He was joking. "I have my butter knife from breakfast." Despite everything, he was able to be a little bit humorous. Then he said, "Okay, I'm going to put the phone down. I'll be right back. I love you."
Philip Bradshaw, husband of Sandra Bradshaw, flight attendant, United Flight 93. We talked about how much we loved each other and our children, and she said, "Everyone is running to first class. I've got to go. Bye." Those were the last words I heard from her.
Lisa Jefferson. Todd turned to someone else and he said, "Are you ready?" I could hear them. They responded. He said, "Okay, let's roll." That was the last thing I heard.
Beginning at 9:57 a.m., the cockpit voice recorder aboard United Airlines Flight 93 captures the sounds of a struggle as the passengers and crew of the hijacked plane stormed the hijackers. At first, as the commotion starts behind them, the hijackers, speaking in Arabic, reported a fight unfolding. A voice is heard in English, shouting, "In the cockpit! In the cockpit!" The hijackers shout to each other to hold the passengers and crew back. At 10 a.m., one of the hijackers asks whether they should crash the plane. "Should we finish it off?" he says. "No, not yet," another replies. "When they all come, we finish it off." The fight continues, and the cockpit voice recorder captures desperate voices in both English and Arabic as the plane's final moments unfold. A hijacker commands his partner flying the plane to push the plane down. Voices in English shout, "Go, go, move, move!" At 10:03 a.m., the final words captured are the hijackers praying as the plane crashes. Seven times they repeat in Arabic the phrase, "God is the greatest. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar." A final English voice is captured shouting, "No!"
Lisbeth Glick. I didn't want to listen to what happened, so I gave the phone to my dad. It wasn't until a couple of days later that I found out what had transpired. My father told me later that he had heard a series of screams. Then there was a series of more screams, and then it sounded like a roller coaster. Then there was nothing.
As the passengers and crew aboard Flight 93 tried to wrest control of the plane from the hijackers, their decisions in the air would alter the lives of those who lived in the small towns in Somerset County near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, who suddenly found themselves in the midst of the nation's still unfolding tragedy. The crash sowed even further confusion among the military and air traffic controllers who were mustering the government to respond to an attack they still didn't understand.
Sergeant Patrick Madigan, Commander, Somerset Station, Pennsylvania State Police. While we were watching, I said, "At least there's no terrorist targets in Somerset County." Shortly thereafter, we received a call from Ed Felt that a plane was over Somerset, and my first thought and reaction to that was, what am I going to be able to do about it?
Rick King, Assistant Chief, Shanksville Volunteer Fire Company. I called my sister, Jody King Walsh. Jody lives in Lambertsville, which is not very far. As I was talking to her, she said, "Rick, I hear a plane." She said, "Rick, it's loud. It sounds like a jet." I said, "Oh my God." I walked out onto my front porch and I could hear the plane. I could hear the engine screaming.
Anita McBride Miller, resident, Stony Creek Township, Pennsylvania. Out of nowhere, this absolutely unbearable, horrific noise was going on outside. It was deafening. It shook the windows and rattled the rafters.
Douglas Miller, coal truck driver, James F. Barron Trucking. I happened to look up in the sky, and there was this giant aircraft coming straight down.
Tim Lensbower, crane operator, Rolock Incorporated. I can't describe what it sounded like. Almost like a missile type. And it came over us real fast, and then it hit the ground. All of a sudden, all the lights went out. It went black, and the whole building shook.
Douglas Miller. I remember getting on the CB and asking my buddy, "Did I see that?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "It didn't look good."
John Worth, air traffic controller, Cleveland Air Route Traffic Control Center. We never lost them from the radar until they took the steep descent into the crash. We observed the target all the way to the southeast of Pittsburgh until 10:03 a.m.
Stacy Taylor Parham, Air Traffic Control Specialist, Cleveland Air Route Traffic Control Center. I vectored another nearby plane toward the incident site and asked if he would look for smoke.
Terry Yazel, pilot, Falcon 20 Corporate Jet, airborne over Pennsylvania. Stacy asked if there was any activity off the right side of the airplane, like smoke or something like that. There were a lot of small white clouds around. After looking around for a while, I saw a puff of black smoke, a black cloud floating. As we got closer, we could see basically a forest fire burning next to a tree line in a field of grass.
Yates Gladwell, pilot, Falcon 20 Corporate Jet, airborne over Pennsylvania. It was a big black hole, and it was smoking.
Ben Sliney. The other plane reported the smoke plume. That drew a close to the day in reality, but we didn't know that yet. In our minds, the attacks were not over, and we continued to track the remaining 8 or 10 or maybe even a dozen planes, monitor their progress, report on what they were doing. Until they were resolved, until their radios came back on, they landed, they did whatever they had to do.
Major General Larry Arnold. We did not know that was the last plane. The war was still on as far as we were concerned.
Lisa Jefferson. I kept calling out Todd Beamer's name, hoping and praying either him or anyone would pick up that phone. Someone touched my shoulder and said, "Lisa." That was their plane. The plane had just crashed in Pennsylvania. You can release the line now. I kept calling and calling. I held that phone an additional 15 minutes, praying someone would pick up.
Lisbeth Glick. My dad stayed on the line for over 2 hours, hoping beyond hope.
Dina Burnett. I kept waiting. I held on to the telephone for almost 3 hours, waiting for him to call back to tell me he had landed the plane and everything was fine and he would be home later. I started thinking about what I could cook for dinner. I was thinking about sending the kids to school and who could come pick them up because I didn't want to miss his phone call. So I just sat there.
There was no place for us to run. Fear at the Pentagon. The first hour of rescue efforts at the Pentagon proved to be a frustrating stop and start, as fire responders noticed that the outer rings of the building, which bore the brunt of the plane's impact, were in danger of collapsing, and officials feared reports that more hijacked aircraft were inbound.
James Schwartz, Assistant Chief for Operations, Arlington County Fire Department. There was the sense of the battlefield, of war, if you will. We were very clear that there may be more waves of the attack coming. At one point early on, FBI Special Agent Chris Combs said to me, "There are still 8 more aircraft that are unaccounted for." We were waiting. Is there going to be another airplane like there was in New York, at the Pentagon? This is an attack the likes of which we've never seen before.
Chris Combs, Special Agent, FBI Pentagon. The FBI Command Center was relaying to me all of the other stories that were out there about other attacks happening. There were stories that the White House had been hit, that the State Department had been hit. One thing I remember hearing was, "Hey, Cleveland has been hit as well." I remember thinking, what's in Cleveland? Why are they hitting Cleveland?
Thomas O'Connor, Special Agent, FBI, Pentagon. We were standing with a guy from the Metropolitan Washington Area Airports Authority who had a radio, and he said, "Hey, you've got a plane that's off radar." He said, "It's a good distance out." I was like, "Okay." But he said, "They're calculating back at the speed it was going or should be going and the direction, how long it would take to get to Washington, D.C., It was more of an urgent matter than I had first thought it was.
Chris Combs. It was on track to D.C. and it was 20 minutes flight time out. They said we had 20 minutes.
James Schwartz. I made a decision to evacuate the incident scene at the Pentagon.
John Jester, Chief Defense Protective Service, Pentagon. We were outside and heard the fire trucks blowing their horns. They said it was for recall, to come down off the building, because of a report of a second plane inbound.
They pulled the firemen off the building for a while. Chris Combs, we looked around and decided the safest places were under the overpasses on the highways. We sent everyone there.
Captain Charles Gibbs, Arlington County Fire Department. I refer to it as everybody out of the pool. On the heliport side, we went back to the other side of Washington Boulevard, which in reality probably wasn't far enough, but that's where we went.
James Schwartz, we picked up all the victims. We got everybody as much as we could off of the incident scene. We stood there getting radio transmissions from the Washington field office of the FBI counting down.
Chris Combs, it was pretty eerie. The Pentagon is absolutely in flames, and there are thousands of first responders and people from the Pentagon huddled underneath all of these overpasses, waiting.
Thomas O'Connor, the hard part about being under the bridge was that you knew the firefighters weren't in there fighting the fire. And every minute they weren't fighting the fire, it was getting further out of hand. They were really frustrated.
Captain Charles Gibbs, that was probably 10, 15 minutes just sitting there.
Thomas O'Connor, they were actually counting down the time.
James Schwartz, we were standing there looking out at the sky, looking to see if an airplane is going to pierce the clouds.
Chris Combs, we got to about 5 minutes past the deadline. People were getting a little antsy. Members of the command team were asking me, hey, what's going on? Where's this plane?
James Schwartz, we were waiting for a word from somebody.
Chris Combs, it was about 10 minutes after that they said it was a confirmed crash at Camp David and we were good to go.
This report of a crash near Camp David was the garbled initial news of the crash of Flight 93, whose Pennsylvania crash location was initially misplaced as being close to the presidential retreat in Thurmont, Maryland, along the Pennsylvania border.
James Schwartz, at that time I ordered everybody back to the incident scene.
Captain Robert Gray, Technical Rescue, Station 4, Arlington County Fire Department. We walked up to the front of the building, and it was unbelievable. My thought was, this feels so evil that somebody has done this. And they did it with a loaded plane. It was overwhelming. We basically started on the first floor and worked our way in. It was obvious on the first floor, once we got all the way to where the plane had hit, that there weren't any survivors.
Oh my God, it's Father Mike. The first casualty. One of the most memorable figures at the Trade Center was Father Michael Judge, one of the FDNY's six chaplains, a gregarious, gay, recovering alcoholic Irishman known throughout the city for ministering to firefighters, the homeless, and AIDS victims. He'd been an FDNY chaplain since 1992 and had responded to numerous emergencies, including the 1996 crash of TWA Flight 800, which exploded over Suffolk County, New York. On 9/11, he was one of the first to arrive at the World Trade Center and is believed to be the only priest who entered the Twin Towers that day.
Michael Judge, Chaplain, FDNY. It's fantastic how I can sometimes begin a day and go through a day, but not realize that everything that happens, every single thing that happens, is somehow within the divine plan. Friar Michael Duffy, priests and firemen both enter people's lives at a point of crisis. They have similar outlooks on life. It's the need to help, to rescue. So you have Mike Judge wanting to do that in a spiritual way, and the fireman wanting to do it in a physical way. It was a natural match.
Malachy McCord, actor. There's a very old postcard of a giant Jesus looking in the window of the Empire State Building in those long, long robes. That was Mike Judge in New York. He was everywhere over the city.
Friar Michael Duffy. On 9/11, one of our friars, Brian Carroll, was walking down 6th Avenue and actually saw the airplane go overhead at a low altitude. Then he saw smoke coming from the Trade Towers. He ran into Michael Judge's room, and said, "Michael, I think they're going to need you. I think the World Trade Tower is on fire." He jumped up, took off his habit, got his FDNY uniform on, and I have to say this, in case you think he's perfect, he did take time to comb and spray his hair. He ran down the stairs and got in his car with some firemen and went to the World Trade Towers. One of the first people he met was the mayor, Mayor Giuliani.
Rudy Giuliani. Father Judge was walking in the other direction. I was walking south, he was walking north. "Father Judge," I said, "please pray for us." He put a smile on his face and said, "I always do." I said, "Thanks." We didn't quite have a chance to do the whole joke. I used to say to him, "Pray for me." He would say, "I will." I'd say, "It's more effective if you pray, because you're in a lot better shape than I am with God." He would say, "Yeah, but it's better if you do it, because it's more unusual, and it will be more of a surprise to God."
For the better part of an hour, Father Judge was a constant, reassuring presence to emergency workers, praying aloud in the North Tower lobby, and dashing outside at one point to administer last rites to a firefighter, Danny Shore, hit and killed by a person falling from the burning tower.
Gregory Freed. I saw Michael Judge, the fire chaplain, and I said, "Father, be careful." He said, "God bless," because he always said, "God bless." Then he headed right, and I went left.
Bill Spade. I'd known him from other incidents, other things, and weddings and all. I'd say, "Hey, Father, how you doing? You remember me?" He'd say, "Sure, I remember you. You got that 20 I lent you?" He was there in the building, in the North Tower. He had his rosary at his side, in his right hand, and he was saying the rosary. He was white. Everything that he was seeing was really bothering him.
Christian Waugh, firefighter, Ladder 5, FDNY. You could see it in his face. He usually joked around. He was always saying hello to somebody. This time, he was stone-faced.
Chief Joseph Pfeiffer. He was in the lobby with us, and I could tell he was praying.
Lieutenant Bill Cosgrove, NYPD. That's when the whole building shook. The lights went out. There was this giant vacuum sound. We thought it was our building, South Tower, that was collapsing. It wasn't. The pressure was sucking the windows out of Tower 1. It was totally dark.
Wesley Wong, Assistant Special Agent in Charge, FBI. I took a couple of steps, and I tripped over what I thought as a piece of debris. I could barely make out the outline of a fireman's bunker coat. I say to some other firemen, "Hey, I think one of your guys is down." Two other firemen go to look in the darkness.
Lieutenant Bill Cosgrove. One of the firefighters put the light on him, and I remember him saying, "Oh my God, it's Father Mike."
Wesley Wong. We picked up Father Judge and we headed out.
Lieutenant Bill Cosgrove. I took an arm, someone else took an arm, two other guys took his ankles.
Wesley Wong. We brought Father Judge back in the orange chair that you see in the famous picture of him. That orange chair was sitting by its lonesome in the mezzanine level. Some of the firemen started working on him, trying to help his breathing. He was in real bad shape at that point.
John McGuire, finance associate, Goldman Sachs. I saw the fireman carrying a man I later discovered was Father Michael Judge in a chair. I offered them a hand. It took five men because the ground was shifting on top of the debris, which made it difficult to walk.
Shannon Stapleton, photographer, Reuters. I noticed some rescue workers carrying this man in a chair. I knew it was a pretty intense image. They weren't too happy.
Lieutenant Bill Cosgrove. I remember looking up because one of the firemen was yelling at a photographer. He was telling him in no uncertain terms, "Get out of the way."
Christian Waugh. At the time, I thought photographing Father Judge that way was in very bad taste. I went after Shannon Stapleton, the photographer. I started screaming at him. I knew that thing was going to be out on the internet in a half hour.
John McGuire. We carried him to a street corner and laid his body on the sidewalk. I pushed on his chest with the thought of starting CPR. No response. We folded his hands and covered his face with a jacket.
Jose Rodriguez, officer, NYPD. We knelt down. I grabbed Father Judge's hand. He was already dead. Lieutenant Cosgrove put his hand on Father Judge's head, and we said an Our Father.
Friar Michael Duffy. The firemen took his body because they respected and loved him so much. They didn't want to leave it in the street. They quickly carried it into St. Peter's Church. They went up the center aisle, and they put the body in front of the altar. They covered it with a sheet. On the sheet, they placed his stole and his fire badge.
Monsignor John Delendick. They told me Michael Judge's body was in St. Peter's Church. I went up there. I had to walk around a bit to do that. And they had him lying in state, almost in front of the altar. I prayed a little bit.
Friar Michael Duffy. Michael Judge's body was the first one released from Ground Zero. His death certificate has the number 1 on the top.
James Hanlon, former firefighter FDNY, the first official casualty of the attack.
Craig Monahan, firefighter, Ladder 5, FDNY. I think he wouldn't have had it any other way. It was as if he took the lead, all those angels, right through heaven's gates. That's what it seemed like to us. If any of those guys were confused on the way up, he was there to ease the transition from this life to the next.
Nobody is coming to get us. Around the towers. Inside the North Tower, the remaining rescuers and building occupants realized they too faced immediate peril as they learned that the South Tower had collapsed.
Captain J. Jonas. The emergency power came up and the lights came on. I looked at fellow firefighter Billy Burke and I said, "What was that?" I said, "Billy, you go check the south windows and I'll go check the north windows and we'll meet back here." I couldn't see anything when I went to my window. All I could see was white dust pressed against the glass. We met back at the stairway and I expected Billy to tell me that something happened with our building. With a straight face, he looked at me and says, "The south tower's collapsed." John Abruzzo, when we got to the 20th floor, I remember hearing a rumble. We knew it didn't sound good. We knew we had to get out of there and not stop for anything.
David Norman. A colleague at the command post, Kenny Winkler, came over the radio and told us that the South Tower had collapsed. Now, I know this sounds a little silly, but if you didn't see that footage on TV and you were locked in a room that doesn't have any windows, when somebody tells you a 110-story building is gone, you want to say to them, "Are you sure?" We communicated some message like that to Kenny, like, "Are you sure?" I think I may have even said, "Calm down," to him, "relay that message again." He came back very boldly, "There's nothing left of the building. You need to get out of there. Your building is in imminent danger of collapse."
Captain J. Jonas, my mind was exploding. I knew from all my studies that a high-rise building had never collapsed before. Now the sister one to the one I was in had collapsed. You start doing the math.
Sharon Miller. I said to the chief, "Hey, chief, this building is coming down next." He goes, "We're going up a couple more, and then we're getting out of here."
Captain J. Jonas. I had this terrible feeling that, man, we're not going to make it out of here. We're on the 27th floor, we're in no man's land, it's going to be hard to get out of here. In addition to that, I had this feeling, geez, I wonder how many firemen died. That was the linchpin that said, "All right, this is no longer a doable mission for us. It's time to get out of here." I looked at my guys and said, "If that one can go, this one can go. It's time for us to get out of here." They were a little, not standoffish, but they were like, "You mean we've got to go downstairs now? We climbed all this way for nothing?" I says, "Come on, let's go. It's time to get out of here." I told them to keep their tools with them because the first thought might be, "Well, let's jettison everything and go." I says, no, you keep everything. As it turns out, it was good that we did.
Detective David Brink. I wanted to go. I had just survived the first collapse, and I was like, all right, I really don't want to go through that again. The South Tower was on fire, obviously, and in ruins on the ground. We saw a lot of civilians. I thought to myself, well, these are the people that were here to help. We can't abandon them now.
David Norman, we felt that we were no longer part of the solution. We were now part of the problem.
Lieutenant Greg Hansen, Engine 24, FDNY. I remember turning to the lieutenant in Ladder 5, Mike Warcola, and telling him, just heard a mayday to get out of the building. We're all leaving. None of us were really in a hurried state at that point because on the 35th floor, everything was as calm as could be.
Sharon Miller. I had a bunch of firemen behind me. You could hear their radios crackling, holy this and holy that, and two just came down. One's coming down next. Mayday, mayday. When PAPD Chief James Romito heard mayday, that's when he said, all right, let's go. We got to get out of here. We were at the 31st floor, 32nd floor, and we all turned around and started coming down.
John Abruzzo. We made it out to the West Street entrance. There was glass all over the place. They had to lift the chair physically off the ground to carry me out into the street. They put me down to rest. It took an hour and a half to get from the 69th floor down to street level. If it weren't for the evacuation chair and the 10 people who brought me down, I would not have made it.
Pasquale Bazzelli. We were the only people on the 64th floor of the North Tower. It wasn't until we felt the building shake and vibrate that we started questioning, okay, now this is getting more serious.
Louise Bazzelli. The second building to get hit started to crumble and come down. I kept thinking, that building is just like his building.
Pasquale Bazzelli. Steve and I looked at each other and he said, what the fuck are we still doing here? Let's get the fuck out. We gathered up rags that we wet, flashlights, whatever we could find, not knowing what we'd encounter on the way down. We formed a line and got ready to leave. We took a head count, 16. I was in the front, not because I was leading or anything. It happened to be where I was standing. Then Pat said, all right, let's go.
Janelle Guzman. Finally, we decided to go down the staircase. My friend Pasquale was leading the way. I held onto my co-worker Rosa's hand. She was holding onto me. She was crying. I didn't cry for some reason. I was trying to comfort her.
Pasquale Bazzelli. We encountered some firemen sitting on the stairs. They were tired and sweaty with their gear. They said, keep going straight down. Keep moving. I don't think their radios were working. If they had known themselves that Tower 2 had collapsed, they would have been going down the stairs with us too. Instead, they were going up.
Louise Bazzelli. I'm praying that I hear the phone ring and it's him and he's going to tell me that he's out and he's somewhere on his way across the river or somewhere away.
Janelle Guzman. Pasquale kept making a couple of stops to ask, are you guys okay? We kept saying, yes, we're doing fine. We kept walking and walking and kept counting the staircases because they had the number written on the columns. I was trying to tell Rosa we're almost there. I was wearing high-heeled shoes, so she was telling me, do you want to take your shoes off? I'm like, no, I'll be all right. I'm doing okay. My feet were killing me going down the stairs. And I wanted to stop, but didn't want to lose a minute.
Tower 2 is gone. After the collapse. Those who survived the collapse of the South Tower emerged into an unrecognizable landscape. Lost and traumatized, some fled, while others searched the wreckage for signs of hope.
Gregory Freed, Executive Chief Surgeon, NYPD. I can't tell you how long I was down, but then it stopped. I wasn't dead, but I was really hurting a lot. I squirmed to my feet, and I guess the rubble was about shoulder high in certain areas. My head was fairly well out of it, but I felt my right buttock, my right cheek, That was where all the pain really was. It was swelling, so I knew I was bleeding. I took my belt, wrapped it around, and started heading to the Hudson.
William Jimeno, officer PAPD, buried under the rubble of the South Tower. Sergeant McLaughlin said, "What's everybody's condition?" Dominic said, "I'm trapped. I think I can shimmy out of here." I told Sarge, "I'm in a lot of pain. My whole left side, I've got concrete on me, and I'm being crushed." At this point, Sergeant McLaughlin was more stuck. He was in a fetal position about 15 feet back. I could hear him, but I couldn't see him. This hallway somehow collapsed and had separated us. He was very calm. After about 7-8 minutes, Dominic shimmied himself up. We were in a very tight compartment, and I was lying on my back at a 45-degree angle. Sarge said, "Are you free?" Dominic said, "Sarge, I can get out of this hole." The hole was about 30 feet up. It looked dangerous. Sergeant McLaughlin said, "No, if you leave, you'll never find us. You need to get Jimeno out, and you and Jimeno get me out." It went on for a couple minutes. "We're human beings, and here you're presented with a situation where you can go out for help, go for freedom and come back, or you stay in, literally, a hellhole with your team." Sergeant McLaughlin, myself, Dominic Pizzullo, Antonio Rodriguez, and Christopher were all fathers. We all had kids. There's no superheroes here. We're regular human beings. Dominic had a real tough decision. In the end, he said, "I'm going to get Will out." He worked on me for about 15 minutes. At that point, he stopped. He said, "I can't get you out." This was about 20, 30 minutes after the initial collapse.
Chief Joseph Pfeiffer, I remember walking north on West Street, walking through the blackness of downtown. I realized my brother was gone, and hundreds of firefighters were gone. All I could think of was how much we really used to love working downtown, and all the times we used to talk on the phone or at the house or at parties about the job. I realized all that was gone.
Al Kim? I looked around and there were firefighters' jackets everywhere. They were everywhere. I remember climbing over debris and someone yelled, "There's someone alive here." Ran over. There was a guy who looked pretty messed up. We had no equipment. There was an ambulance burning, and all those vehicles I lined up, they were all on fire. Every last one of them. I went in one of those, grabbed some stuff. I grabbed the longboard, and whatever we did, we did. I don't remember doing any of it, but we did it.
Jean Potter. I started walking in the gray dust. I was soaked because in the concourse, water had been pouring from the ceiling. People were yelling at me to cover my mouth, but I said, "Which way are the towers? Are they behind me?" I didn't want to be walking toward them. I made my way to Chinatown and tried to use the phone. I wanted to get as far away from the towers as possible.
Stephen Biankowski. All of Lower Manhattan was covered in a giant white dust cloud. As we came around in our helicopter to the North Tower again, you could still see people falling and jumping, except it didn't look so violent anymore because you weren't watching them hit the ground. It almost looked peaceful because they were falling into a white cloud. Andrew Kurtzman, reporter, New York One. My taxi headed toward Chambers Street near City Hall, and the taxi driver slammed on the brakes. He said, "I'm not going any further. Get out of here." I fumbled for my money, and this woman outside opened up the cab and climbed in next to me. She yelled, "Get me out of here." I said, "Give me a second. I'm leaving." "You're leaving?" I said, "I'm a reporter. I've got to go cover the story." She looked incredulous. He dumped me out on the street, and I was alone on Chambers Street, which on a daytime, on a weekday, is normally packed. The street was covered with white soot. It was eerily quiet, and it was incredibly disorienting.
Lila Spessener. It looked almost like a snow globe, only it was flying papers and dust from the falling building. We still didn't realize what had happened. We are soaking wet, and I had debris in my hair, my ripped stockings, whatever. There were emergency people wandering around. "Are you hurt? Go here. If you're not hurt, walk north. Go away from this building. We don't know what's going to happen next. Walk away."
Frederick Turner, Holocaust survivor and Brooklyn resident. As ashes were falling, I was back in Auschwitz, with ashes coming down.